Hello, everybody, and welcome to Turn to Page, Season 6, Book 5 of Choose Cthulhu, The Dun Itch Horror, which we have learned ahead of time so as not to embarrass ourselves. Dun Itch, not Dun Witch, which does sound tasty. Mm-hmm. What would be on a Dun Witch?
Oh, that doesn't sound tasty. I'm so sorry. Immediately, the only thing I can think of is dunny. That's the Australian word for loo, toilet, outhouse. Doesn't sound good.
Yeah.
It feels like it should be dung, right? It feels like it's a sandwich made out of dung.
I mean, I was going to go with the, like, a dun, which is what happens when you finish your sandwich. Like, there's nothing on
that.
There's nothing on it. It's a Dunwich, you know. But
how are you doing with that sandwich, Ashley? I'm Dunwich.
Yeah. Oh. I also like the title. You know, read in the different version. Sounds like an accusation, but also a question at the same time. You've done witch horror.
I mean, hey.
There's a bunch of horrors in this area. Which of them have you done? I mean, what are you responsible for?
It's pretty. I mean, accurate for what the success state of the book is, too.
Yes.
It's not like being out of it. It's your success state is figuring out which horror was done. And that's how you know you've won.
By the end, we'll have done which horror. Let's find out in this book.
Yeah. I do want to point out that the love the cover, like there is this little squid baby mixed with Nosferatu. And I know that it's not supposed to be cute, but it kind of is.
It is. It is. Yeah. It's unfortunately adorable.
Yeah. But hey, let us move on, I guess, to the back of the book where you wanted to introduce it to us.
Beware the unclean mysteries of the great old ones. Something disturbs the stillness of the isolated town of Dunwich.
I knew I was going to do it. Dunwich.
Rumors regarding their peculiar Whateley family are rife, and the connection to impious rituals has become the talk of the few who still dwell in the rough mountains of Massachusetts. What rites and spells lie in the pages of the feared Necronomicon so coveted by the Whateleys? Can you survive the horrors that lurk in the hills and farms of Dunwich?
Dunwich. I knew it! Again! And this book is just laid with a bunch of traps for me.
Yeah, it's... Aha, you've activated my trap card. I also just like the idea that was actually the narrator. I mean, it was in this situation, but, you know, Dunwich. Jeez, man. Like, in a very serious horror environment. Gosh darn.
Just Wayne June correcting himself halfway through a line.
Yeah.
Antediluvian. Antediluvian.
Overcompetence. Oh, wait. No. Anyways. All right. On to page one.
Woo!
You are... Okay. You are Professor Henry Armitage, a Bachelor of Letters from Miskatonic University, a Doctor of Philosophy from Princeton University, and a Doctor of Letters, again, from Johns Hopkins University. You're the Chief Librarian and Archivist.
The S in Hopkins is silent.
Yes.
The first S, not the second one.
Yeah. So silent, it's not even there. You're the Chief Librarian.
It's invisible, sorry.
Archivist at Miskatonic University in Arkham. Wow. Okay. So we are...
Is this the same guy from the last novel?
I'm trying to remember if their name was Henry Armitage or not. They definitely had the same, you know, we were a letter and philosophy main in school.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, no. Previously with George Aberdeen, but I do believe Henry Armitage was mentioned in this book.
Yeah. The word Armitage, the name Armitage is very familiar.
I'm just going to bring this up because it was in the introduction for the previous book. Gotcha. The ancient parchment that tells you about the nameless city in the desert of Arabia. In your following days, you sought advice from some of your colleagues, such as Henry Armitage, whose doctorate in letters and philosophy qualified him as one of the best trained minds in the university.
I see. We were the man that we roasted.
Yes.
I thought that.
And now we must live the roast.
I thought that in my head, I was like, oh, that other character we were playing was this bachelor of letters and philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
But hey. It's October 25th, 1914, as this sunny afternoon comes to an end, you're driving on the road to Aylesbury in the central region of Massachusetts. The purpose of this trip is to study some megalithic settlements in the area. According to your preliminary search, it's an establishment of rocks and ritual shrines dating long before the colonization era. You plan to arrive at Aylesbury before the sunset and remain there for about a week. At the crossroads with the toll road to Aylesbury just past Dean's Corner, you accidentally take the wrong fork. You realize your error some 3 or 4 miles further down the road and turn to retrace your route back to the main road. From the dusty and winding mountain roads, you notice a forested area in the depths of the rocky valley. At the center of this ravine, you see a lone village surrounded by hills. Someone there might be able to help you get to Aylesbury. Oh boy. Drive to the center of the village on page 52. This always goes well.
Can I clarify, why can't we just drive up the other fork of the road?
Like, yeah, it's like we've eliminated
that far.
We've eliminated the options already. It's not the way we came, and it isn't the way we went, so it's the third way. Let's just try the other fork again, just to make sure.
Yeah, by process of elimination, let me go back on the first road again, just in case it's that one now.
Yeah.
All right. Check out Aylesbury. Check out the small town to see if they can help us get to Aylesbury.
Mm-hmm. The road leads to the main street of the Silent Village. Ooh, Silent W's Silent Village.
Mm-hmm. You're not supposed to pronounce any of the letters in it.
Do not perceive or pronounce me. Where there's almost no movement. The only sounds come from the wind stirring the treetops and the erratic squawking of some birds that can only be heard in rural areas, such as this. They sound like whippoorwills. Are you familiar?
I've heard that word said. I wouldn't have been able to tell you that that's a bird.
Yeah, but you're not certain because you don't know what that is. Past a corner, you find a peculiar tavern. The sign is a simple wooden board on which the name of the place has been fire branded. Osborne. You'd like to drive past it, but you're lost. But it'd be best to ask the villagers for assistance. You park the car, you go in, and immediately a few pairs of eyes acknowledge your presence. They cast suspicious glances at you. Perhaps it'd be best not to reveal your desire to escape this village just yet. Besides, your dry throat demands a drink. It may be more prudent to take a seat and order something first. Our instincts are bad.
I don't know, right? Because imagine, you live in a small town. You know every single person in this town by name. There's a maximum of like 85 people in this town. We're talking about a town where you need to go and manually update the estimated population sign every time a baby is born or someone dies, right? You hope those both happen on the same day so you don't have to update the sign.
Saves a trip.
Now, in this town, a random stranger walks into the place of establishment and community congress where everyone spends their time in the Osborne Tavern. Walks in and says, how the hell do I get out of this goddamn town?
I mean, fair, but also I think it's easy to just be like, hey, I'm lost, but I don't know.
Yeah, we're going to have to update the sign. Welcome to the town, stranger.
Population 12 and that guy who's just here for a little bit.
It'll be 13 soon.
Find a table and get a sense of this place on page 50. You sit and you order a beer, looking covertly at the patrons, who don't seem to be the brightest. Okay, well. Some have gathered in front of the bar, rustically clad. Most have tattered jumpsuits stained with horse dung mixed with wisps of hay. Judging by their rumination, you'd say that they are tobacco chewers. What is happening, guy? Just chill. Just chill, man. The center of attention, however, is an old man with a severe countenance and a diabolical stare. Standing in front of the bar, the old man bangs his fists on the wooden surface and starts to rant loudly.
All that hearsay matters none to me,
he says.
If that Wilbur, Lavinia's boy, is anything like his pa, you'd better brace yourself for something very unusual, I'm telling you lot. Her man is as good a husband as any from this side of Aylesbury. I'll tell you this, One day, you'll hear Lavinia's boy calling his par's name at the very top of Sentinel Hill.
One of the patrons chimes in, so drunk that he's slurring his words, but clearly not mincing them.
The only thing we know around here, Master Whateley, is that your daughter Lavinia's snotty boy is hard to look at. And that something strange happened that night the fella was born last Candlemas. The mutts were barking all night here in Dunwich, and we all knew something was wrong.
Dunwich? When you hear that name, you remember reading something about it. Maybe on the cover. Try and recall what it was on page 28. Candlemas, by the way.
I like it.
I like it. I like candles. I don't know.
I'd celebrate candles. I believe in candles.
I'm confident about candles.
I've personally seen candles.
I lit a candle just yesterday.
Ooh, what was the occasion?
Nighttime.
That's a good one. Scarcely useful in the day.
They're just for the smells in the day. I've lit candles in the day. I do it, so you know. But this one's occasion was nighttime and not daytime. So that's how you know it was twofold. It was both to make the vibes a little bit more Halloweeny. It was a pumpkin-y kind of spice type candle.
Ooh,
to go with
season for pumpkin spice.
Yeah, to go with the nice Halloween decorations that are now up. So I guess that's the occasion. That specific candle's occasion was Halloween-y nighttime. Anywho, it's said that Dunwich grew in a climate of ignorance. And let's say that. Let's just say that. It grew in a climate of ignorance. And that the average level of literacy is extremely low. Many families, like the Bishops, the Whateleys, the Sawyers, the Fries, have grown through... They're romantically entangled with their own, we'll say. That's the way I'll put that. In the newspaper archives are records of depravity, hushed murders, harsh violence, and never-ending perversity. They also detail ungodly rituals, acts of witchcraft, and Dunwichcraft? And impious ceremonies atop certain hills, one of them being Sentinel Hill, which the perfidious old man just mentioned. The evocation of that site reminds you of a parallel memorandum that alluded the strange disposition of the altar-shaped stones on that summit. You think yourself lucky that you ended up here, although the atmosphere feels undeniably sinister. I mean, to be fair, we walked in here and we've been casting mad aspersions on these folks.
Oh, yeah.
So I think that we might be the one that's making the vibe a little bit sinister here. But hey.
I read in a book in my university that all of you do the bad sex things. It said it in a book.
Also,
the book also
the
said you're
bad?
Dumb.
The book said you're dumb. Why are the vibes bad here? Why are you looking at me funny? You smell bad. You got dung on your shirt. Why are you looking at me weird?
Do you eat it? Why are you looking at me weird?
Also, the vibes are sinister. Anyways.
Can I order a beer, if you understand that word?
That's right. I forgot. I forgot that I also read that you're illiterate. Yeah. That's just wow. In any case, it might not be a bad idea to organize an expedition to the summit of Sentinel Hill. If, despite its reputation, you decide to stay in Dunwich, where you might find out something interesting, go to page 54. If you believe it wiser to just go back to Arkham, given that your stay in Dunwich may put you at risk, go to page 115. I mean, this is one of those choices.
Canonically, I think this character, I think Henry Armitage, extremely underestimates everyone here and is not threatened. Is just like,
I think
all of these backwards folk, I guess.
Yeah. I also think that it feels as though it would move the story along further to just go to page 54 and stay.
Mm-hmm.
And also...
Also think the other one, if we did check it, would literally just be, all right, you got home and you never think of Dunwich again.
Yep.
We could check it if you'd like.
Nah, I'm good. We've seen enough of those to know that that's the case. But, there, you know, it could also be a whole path on its own. It's like you go back and you come back eventually. And then I don't know. But I think 54, I think you're right. I think our character is just too not aware to be concerned properly. It isn't a very welcoming atmosphere, all these stupid idiots, but an investigation But an investigation in this rustic village may be more fruitful than the charming town of Aylesbury. Your stay in Dunwich completely disrupts your initial plans, but you feel confident in your ability to improvise. A few minutes pass and the crowd dissipates. Still, a laggard approaches your table, wearing a shabby straw hat and has weak old stubble.
You're not from round here, are you?
He says.
No.
You answer.
I come from Arkham. Earl Sawyer.
He introduces himself. Not giving you any time to reply, he sits right in front of you.
You thinking of staying here for a while?
Yes, I was studying megalithic settlements and might be interested in visiting that, Sentinel Hill.
The man stifles a drunken chuckle.
What?
You ask.
Is there something that I should know about that place, or about the old Whateley?
He holds back another chuckle.
There are many stories about them Whateleys,
he says.
Everyone here knows they are sorcerers, especially that old man, been blabbering nonsense for about a year and a half about deformed grandson. They know a lot about them boulders up there. If you're interested, we could pay him a visit.
If you'd like to know more about the Whateleys and their relationship with the megalithic settlements, accompany Sawyer to the Whateley farm on page 12. Otherwise, mind your own business and organize your own expedition to Sentinel Hill on page 109.
Mind your own business.
I mean, that's... I don't think this character would mind
You don't think
business.
They would
mind
their own
business?
Business,
judging just based off of the fact that they haven't.
Vibes. Mm-hmm. Vibes and precedent.
Vibes and precedent and actions. And words and actions, and the future. So,
let's meet on 12 then.
Alrighty. Sawyer leads you to the Whateley farm. There we go. Sure, nailed it. This was your idea, but on your way there, you start feeling off about it. He talks about the constant changes that old Whateley makes in his estate, expanding the barn, removing the initial partitions. He also mentions the fact that the old man purchases significant amounts of livestock each week. Either him or his cousin, Zachariah Whateley. However, the cattle disappear from the field from one day to the next. Sawyer also mentions the old man's strange collection of books which he has been using to educate his daughter, Lavinia. He also talks disturbingly at length about the details of the ceremonies that the family performs atop Sentinel Hill on certain nights of the year. Sawyer's allusions reach the level of absurdity which he mentions an odd, well, that apparently... Old Whateley, has dug in his cousin Zachariah's basement.
A well that nearly dooms the whole damn village!
According to Sawyer, which seems to be connected to the disappearance of the tourists and foreigners who are roaming around Dunwich. Your mind is a hodgepodge of rumors and hearsay, and Sawyer's voice, with its never-ending chatter, drills into your brain. Finally, you arrive at the farm. Observe the construction on page 130. Sawyer knocks on the door and the old man himself opens up. You go inside. The interior is somber and sinister. The smell is unpleasant. His daughter is a pale, hunchbacked woman in her mid-30s. Once again, I think that we're bringing the vibes, but okay.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it weird? Everyone but me is deformed and dumb.
And dumb and ugly and smelly. And also, I'm getting just bad vibes. Her eyes are milky white and she has a glazed stare. She's buttoning up a strange morning coat that her son is wearing. He's a cocky kid who looks to be about 4 or 5 years old. He has a gruesome face. His visage is utterly monstrous. Apart from being chinless, his features are goatish. Goat-like. Unlike anything you've seen or imagined in other humans. His size is also remarkable, considering you've heard at Osborne's that he was born just a year and a half ago. You see that he's babbling and whispering to his mother. Sawyer and the old man start to talk business, settling a debt related to some livestock Sawyer sold him last week. You look around the dusty, dimly lit living room lying open on the large table affixed to the wall. You see a queer book. You quietly walk nearer and take a look. It's Witten? Written in an undecipherable
it's
script.
It's a silent R.
It's a, yeah. It's written in an undecipherable, script, and is heavily annotated. There are a couple of jars of strange granular powder nearby, while the walls are covered with bookcases stacked with ancient tomes. The air in this house is dense, and the odor clinging to it is excruciating. You hear strange noises from upstairs, violent jolts of muffled bellowing! Fortunately... Sawyer and the old man seem to be finished, allowing him to abandon this suffocating cabin. Leave and head towards page 114. Disturbed by what you've just witnessed at the farm, you're unable to utter a word until you arrive at Osborne's store. A drink suffices to break your silence.
Was that the grandchild that the old man was talking about this morning?
You ask?
Yes, sir.
Confirms Sawyer.
Told you he's no regular kid. All cause them cursed rituals they put up on Hallowmas and Walpurgis Night. Oh, God knows how they made such a creature.
You don't know either, but you're starting to suspect that something sinister is happening in this village. Yes. Yes, you sure are still feeling that way. You still can't figure out how that peculiar family and the megalithic remains of Sentinel Hill are connected, but your curiosity grows.
There are special rocks up there.
Okay. All right, okay. I like Sawyer. I don't care. There's the special rocks up in there.
There's the I swear them rocks. Boulders is unusual.
Says Sawyer when you ask him about it.
Old Waitley uses them to call summit. At least that's what them book says.
What book?
You press him, thinking of that strange copy you saw at the old man's farm. Sawyer sets his beer aside and leans forward, speaking confidently.
The one I nicked from is ours not long ago.
He whispers.
And a very strange one at that, Professor. Maybe you could work with it with your wits and all.
Scratch at your chin. You don't lose anything by accompanying Sawyer to his house and taking a look at that book. Do that. On page 133. Sawyer lives four blocks from Osborne, so you get there in a matter of minutes. On your way, you hear the demented whippoorwills again, but your companion seems unbothered. Sawyer lives in a rickety cabin with a sagging roof and termite-eaten walls. It stinks inside, and there are swarms of buzzing flies swarming all around the living room. Sawyer is clearly poor, and it's a miserable atmosphere, albeit slightly menacing.
Oh, they can't stop dunking on people!
Just chill! Just chill, dude!
He's poor and smelly, and his home sucks.
All right. Without saying a word before he invites you to take a seat on one of his rickety chairs, Sawyer crouches down and rips up a floorboard in the kitchen. Removing it, he produces the book he stole from old Waitley. When you see the title on the cover, you immediately recognize it. It's the famous... Raps does this word.
Demon de Latreille.
Yep, by Remigius, a renowned historian and witch hunter from the 16th century. You wonder how this heavily annotated copy could have ended up in the hands of someone like Waitley.
I nicked it from old Waitley not long ago,
says Sawyer proudly.
Gone mad over it, he has. He knows someone stole it, and if he finds out it were me, oh boy. You keep it. It might come in handy for you.
You take it. Are you willing to chance keeping it? Agree to keep it and start flipping through the pages on 56, or refuse to accept such a poisoned gift and keep investigating on 140?
There is zero chance that this doctor of letters and philosophy, who True. Doesn't believe that any of these people know anything, would take caution with an item like this. I think he'd be like, oh, information!
I do agree with that. If we find that, like, this is cursed text, and when you read it, your mind gets warped, and the only reason this town is fine is because it's illiterate, I swear to God.
I legitimately believe that's the only reason Sawyer is implied to be fine right now, yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's probably a bad idea to do it, but I'm happy to do it.
It's the Daffy looking at duck season and going, I'd be worried about that if I could read.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much. Oh, well, I can't read. All right, so 56, let's... Yeah, that could stop us because we can read, but we won't because we can't read the room. You know how risky it'd be to keep that book, especially given the old Waitley already suspects that it was stolen, but it feels as though you found a rare copy, not just because of the edition.
It's a one-of-a-kind printing from 1718.
But also because the notes in the margins seem to have been penned by old Waitley himself. His comments plainly describe the rituals that he regularly practices in front of some megalithic remains atop the certain hill. And he references numerous times a deity called Yog-Sothoth. Obviously, the information is worth its weight in gold. It'd be an unforgivable sin to leave it in possession of the profane Earl Sawyer. Grateful for his kindness, though, you hold on to the book, and you leave his shack, ready to decide what to do next. Having found quite the jackpot with the book, and wary of what might happen now that you've kept it, you can look for a way back to Arkham. Oh, wait, Arkham on page 115. Or having uncovered a fascinating thread stained Dunwich and try and find out more about the Whateley family on page 100.
I feel like I've been dictating a lot what Henry Armitage would do, but these both feel open.
They really do. So this is almost like a... It feels stupid to just be like, all right, we're done now. Thanks for the book. Bye-bye. But like,
but
would the character...
I don't think it would necessarily get us back to Arkham, because we've still got to escape the town.
It's true. It says you look for a way back to Arkham. That is true. That is a good point. And that I think that maybe our character would do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm down with that. They look for a way out, and we'll see.
Yeah, I don't think this is just going to immediately take us back to Arkham.
Yeah, no, probably not. However, much or little you've seen and heard in Dunwich, you know that you shouldn't extend your stay any longer. Asking for directions from the more trustworthy-looking locals, you locate a bumpy country road that fortunately leads to Aylesbury. You leave this disturbing county behind, and something tells you that it won't be your last visit. You drive towards Aylesbury and then back to Arkham. Return to the tranquility of your city on page 38.
Auspiciously, oh. There's also a Tommy gun on this page.
Yeah, why? You're back in the civilized world, relief washing over you. Your trip to Aylesbury didn't work out as expected because you took a wrong turn that led you to Dunwich. But it's all right. You may have a chance to set on a new expedition soon. However, from now on, you vow to pay close attention to any forks in the tricky dirt roads of Massachusetts. That same afternoon, you return to the university and settle down in your comfortable office. For now, whatever you brought with you from Dunwich, be it experiences or artifacts, can be safely stored in some corner of your memory and workplace. At this moment, better you should focus on the many scholarly tasks pending on your desk. Does that mean that we can, like, actually store, like, mentally note to store the book here?
Let's keep it in mind.
Keep that in mind. Time goes peacefully on to page 78. Your daily routine, family life, the small moments of leisure, but especially your working life and your intense intellectual activity, make the passing of time unnoticeable. Soon the years are piling into one another. A world war breaks out and the newspapers report on the details of the conflict and the hardships that humanity is facing. Wow, we really did just be like, it was just straight up like, you leave the city and then years pass.
Yep.
Wow, okay. Reading the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Boston Globe fill you in on the national and global reality. Although you never quit reading the humble Arkham Advertiser, which keeps you up to date on all the local news, every now and then you find a piece about some event that has taken place in Dunwich. They almost always follow the same pattern: earthquakes, invading whippoorwills, massive losses of livestock, dark ceremonies atop hills. In 1917, the village makes headlines because the government is conducting a survey there. A humble federal investigation that tries to understand the low level of enlistment from Dunwich. The cause is, of course, that's the thing that finally makes them investigate. No, I mean that too, but like the government, oh man, it's time to finally get involved because not enough of them are signing up for the army. Of course, that's the final straw. The cause is determined to be the poor health of its inhabitants. On August 2nd, 1924, the Advertiser prints the obituary of old Noah Whateley, who passed away in Dunwich the previous night. Every once in a while, remnants of your experience in the village haunt your dreams. Eventually, one January afternoon in 1928, the county crosses paths with you once more. After more than 13 years, you meet again with Dunwich. Heed its calling on page 32. You're in your office when suddenly the furious barking of the guard dog distracts you. Never heard it bark with such ferocity. You frown and wait on it expectantly, and a few moments later, a deep and cavernous voice says your name in the hallway, and something points out your office. A slight stench, thoroughly unpleasant, swims up your nostrils. After a brief knock, the door opens, revealing a fearsome visage. Your visitor introduces himself as Wilbur Whateley. He's a disproportionately tall and lanky individual. At first glance, you venture that he might be over 8 feet tall. He has a chinless, goat-like face, stretched lips, and deep eyes. He's wearing a long coat buttoned all the way from his neck down to his feet. He smells horrendous. Gotta get that one in there. Your memories from Dunwich and the hideous connotations of the surname Whateley flood your mind. Wilbur Whately is that the creature born in 1913? Is this towering, hairy-faced individual with the deep voice only 15 years old?
I came to check out one of your copies, Professor.
He says.
And a very special one.
Which one?
You ask fearfully.
The complete version of this one.
With these words, he deposits a tattered volume on your desk. It's a bundle of papers with Necronomicon written on the cover. Astonished, try and respond on page 4. Doesn't take you long to recognize the volume. This is clearly the English version of the Necronomicon. This translation was undertaken by Dr. John Dee, a mathematician and occultist. However, this copy has been severely mistreated. Very little remains of the original binding, and plenty of sheets are haphazardly hand-stitched together. The margins of the pages are full of notes in inks of different colors. You certainly have a complete and canonical copy of the Necronomicon at the university library. The Latin version, translated by Olaus Wormius, 1228. Names were wild. Names were wild then, man. Olaus Wormius.
Bring it back.
Bring it back. Olaus Wormius. I like it. As a librarian and archivist at Miskatonic University, you are aware that the blasphemous book from Alhazred is one of the pieces most coveted by collectors. Yet, it is one of the most dangerous texts to ever exist. At that moment, the visitor makes a new demand, and you take a moment to ponder. How risky would it be if you let this book fall into the hands of a descendant of old Whately? Would it be wise to allow him to peruse it? How would he react if you refused? You need to make a crucial decision. Aware of the danger it poses, you deny him access on the Necronomicon on page 40, or fearful of the reaction, grab the tome and let him check it out on page 118.
Are we more fearful? Or more, I guess, defensive?
I'm going to let you have this one.
I kind of want to try and deny him access to the Necronomicon, because I think that this kind of a character would be like, no, knowledge is for those who understand it, and like look down upon this person. Like, no, you get that information by going through the school and academia tracks. Yeah. Or, of course, by pilfering it from a godforsaken man in a shack.
Yeah. You'd go, sorry, there's no pictures in here.
It's not a pop-up.
It's not a pop-up book. Here, I've got something more your speed. Here's the dining mat for an Applebee's.
Have you already read Sea Spot Run? I can read it to you.
All right, let's go page 40. Let's do it. Let's say no. A descendant of the Whately's accused of witchcraft in Dunwich for centuries, laying hands on the Necronomicon? That's a risk you can't take. You adamantly refuse him access to the forbidden book. Of course, you provide him with an
entirely fictional
administrative reason for it, arguing that he would need a special certificate to peruse such material. You brace yourself for his reaction, which doesn't take long to manifest itself. The misshapen, asymmetrical features of his face twitch horribly before he starts to huff through his dreadful, goat-like lips. Eventually, between snorts, he manages to speak up.
You've no idea what I can do if you won't let me see that book,
he says.
I must.
He bangs his fists on your desk.
That's how it's gonna be, isn't it?
He says.
Perhaps Harvard won't be as stuck up as you.
With that, he picks up his jumble of poorly bound papers and stares at you with utter contempt. He leaves your office, hunching significantly to walk through the doorway. Relieved, you sit down and wring your hands. It's time to ponder the meaning of this visit on page 9.
Why was he here? What did he want?
Why did he smell? Who was he? You are in emotional turmoil after Wilbur Whately's visit, which is unsurprising considering his appearance and intentions. In any case, you are confident that denying him access to the Necronomicon was the wisest thing to do. You are aware that the copy of Alhazred's cursed book stored at the Miskatonic is not the only one available in the region. Therefore, you make a few calls to the heads of different university libraries that you know to warn them about Wilbur's intentions. You aren't especially concerned that Wilbur might go unnoticed by them, or by anyone for that matter, but you're particularly emphatic with the Professor Arthur Hennessy, Dean of Harvard University in Cambridge, because the other traceable copy of the Necronomicon is to be found there. You're lucky that the rustic Whately's have limited resources, otherwise they're poor, you see. Otherwise, you wouldn't put it past Whately to cross the Atlantic to London or Paris, where it's also possible to check out the Necronomicon. Finishing your calls, you ask the guards down in the basement to bring the volume in question to your office, where you skim a few demented passages before you slam it shut. You're not in the right state of mind at this moment to delve into it. You shove it away, but you intend to study a few paragraphs tomorrow or sometime this week. That's how I read books, too. Mm-hmm. For now, try and forget about Wilbur Whateley and get back to work on page 23. That night, your wife leaves your home at the university to take care of her elderly mother, who's been admitted to a hospital nearby. This means you'll spend the night alone, a great opportunity to settle down in your office and dedicate some hours to the pages of the Necronomicon. Even through your erudition in the field of grimoires is well established, you've never completed a reading of this accursed book because legend has it the Necronomicon can lead its reader into madness and disgrace. You know that it's mere superstition, and you reason that no form of literature could produce such effects. Shortly after dinner, you settle down in your reading chair and devote your entire afternoon to the Necronomicon. I'd like to read the Necronomicon. Why not?
Yeah. What could it do? I'm already disgraced and mad.
So true. The content, although blasphemous, is interesting enough to prevent you from setting it aside. It's a real page-turner. The Necronomicon. You lose track of time, and before you know it, it's already 2:00 in the morning. You're completely engrossed by the declamations, as lyrical as they are devilish, of the madman. Then, all at once, a series of unusual noises snaps you back to reality. You hear the guard dogs of the university bark just before you're jolted by the ringing of 2 shots. You put the book aside and look out the window, which faces the lush university gardens, and as you do, a pounding at your office door makes your blood run cold. Someone is coming to visit you on page 129. Well, don't go there, then. The pounding on the door is terrible, and the hinges fail. The door slams back, reveals Wilbur Whateley behind it. He's taken off the coat and that he was wearing during his afternoon visit. Under the goatish face and devilish stare, you see the well-developed, hairy torso. However, words fail to describe what you see from the waist down. Wilbur's limbs feature a pair of goat hooves, which are surrounded by a series of tentacles and polyps, sporting all sorts of abnormal bulges. Several deformities that look like ciliated eyes and strange toothed mouths grow around his hips. Some of his tentacles end in sucker-like mouths or underdeveloped larynxes. Only a vivid nightmare could conjure up such a creature. Wilbur has a gun.
Oh, now I'm scared.
Wilbur, this is not a joke, Wilbur wields a revolver, still smoking from its barrel. He drops it on the carpet and sets his eyes immediately on the copy of the Necronomicon, which has fallen to the floor.
Thank you very much, Professor.
He stammers.
I knew you would finally concede.
Before you can react, he pounces on you and digs his horrendous caprine teeth right into your stomach. You feel a violent jolt and your guts end up splattered on your office floor. The last thing you see is Whateley leaving your office with the Necronomicon in his hands. You hear screams and police sirens that are wailing nearby. They'll probably apprehend him and retrieve the book. But who knows how they'll react when they see such a figure running around the campus. But it doesn't matter. You won't live to see the outcome of the end. I can't believe
Good
he
Lord.
Just shot us.
He shot us? And then he ate us?
Yeah.
The disrespect. I mean, like, sure. Sure. We might be a little equal. Yeah. The disrespect goes both ways. But we didn't shoot any of them, and we certainly didn't dig our goat teeth into any.
Yeah, I nary disemboweled a single man.
Precisely.
Come on! Have some tact.
Does this mean our last branch is giving him the Necronomicon? All right.
Which,
give him the Necronomicon on 118.
I'd assume doesn't go well either, but hey, we'll see. Wilbur Whateley looks so fearsome, and his emotional state is so fragile. In an attempt to be reasonable, you grant him access to the Necronomicon, but only after a few precautions. No cheesy snacks while you're reading this book. You can't get your dust on the page. No cheater fingers. You cannot use the book as a coaster. And also,
don't
read it.
I don't want any of your wetter tentacles touching it.
I don't want your stinky eyes to gaze upon any of the text in the book either. You contact...
Actually, no. I'm going back to the other page. I'm denying you access.
Yeah. You contact the warehouse in the basement through the campus intercom and ask the janitors to fetch a copy of the Necronomicon. Is that their job? Carefully stored under the lock and key, and you bring it to your office. poor janitors, man. Wilbur Waitley's face glows wickedly, and he hears your request. A moment later, you welcome the janitors at the door. Multiple. It took multiple janitors to get the... Okay. Give them a raise. I already know. Just give them a raise. Where you ask them to stay and remain vigilant in case something unusual happens. Really give them a raise. They're bodyguards, too?
Yep. They should be getting the wages of three people.
You come back in with the book and start to hand it to Wilbur, who snatches it from you. He opens it at once and starts flicking through the pages. Then, without taking his eyes off the book, he sits at one of the reading tables and starts comparing this volume to his filthy stack of moldy papers. Determined to monitor his every action, you stand behind him and keep a close eye. You soon realize that he must be looking for something specific. He turns the pages with haste until he gets to page 751 of Olaus Wormius's translation. Surreptitiously peek at the text that Wilbur is so interested in on page 88. Ooh, this is a raps. The text on page 751 reads as follows.
Nor is it to be thought that man is either the oldest or last of Earth's masters, or that the common bulk of life and substance walks alone. The old ones were, the old ones are, and the old ones shall be. Not in the spaces we know, but between them. They walk serene and primal, undimensioned as to us, unseen. Yog-Sothoth knows the gate. Yog-Sothoth is the gate. Yog-Sothoth is the key and guardian of the gate. Past, present, future, all are one in Yog-Sothoth. He knows where the old ones broke through of old, and where they shall break through again. By their smell can men sometimes know them near, but of their semblance can no man know, saving only in the features of those who've been gotten on mankind. They walk unseen and foul in lonely places where the words have been spoken and the rites howled through their seasons. The wind gibbers with their voices, and the earth mutters with their consciousness. As a foulness shall ye know them. Their hand is at your throats, yet ye see them not. Their habitation is one with your guarded threshold. Yog-Sothoth is the key to the gate where the spheres meet. Man rules now where they ruled once. They shall once rule now where man rules. After summer is winter, and after winter, summer. They wait, patient and potent, for here shall they reign again.
It is, without a doubt, a frightening text. But now, hold your breath and check to see what Wilbur is doing on page 68. Wilbur starts copying the contents of the page frenetically, using a blunt pencil. He transcribes it onto a blank page in his damaged volume with a terrible, almost cryptographic script. Looking over his shoulder, you understand why he has trouble writing. His fingers don't seem human, but rather the claws of a bird of prey. It takes him a while to copy the text, during which he breathes loudly, apparently agitated. You find it very difficult to stay close to him, because a nauseating smell emanates from his body.
By their smell can men sometimes know them near,
you hear in your head. Once done, he frantically flicks through the Latin Necronomicon again, seeming desperate, barely skimming the pages, but a sense of urgency coupled with your uncomfortable supervision has him on edge.
I need more, Professor Armitage,
he cries.
I need to find every reference that Al-Hazred makes to the god Yog-Sothoth.
You barely catch the name of the deity spoken on such caprine lips. It's the word of the day. I'm probably saying it wrong. I guess goat-like.
I believe so, yeah. Capra, Capricorn.
Caprine. Resembling goats. Caprine lips. There it is. His earnestness doesn't seem feigned. Then he furiously stands up.
But I ain't about to spend the day in this office either. I've got to return home quickly.
He closes the book and looks you straight in the eye, his next request glimmering in the dark pupils. Listen to it on page 11.
Professor Armitage,
he says,
I need to compare these two copies of the Necronomicon calmly and find any sort of reference to Yog-Sothoth. But I have to do it in me house, you see. I promise to take excellent care of the book and to work hard day and night on to bring it about as soon as possible.
The Necronomicon is a peruse at the library only book, Mr. Waitley.
You have late fees. Excuse me. You interrupt him.
I'm sorry, but you cannot check it out. In fact, I believe you have already read it extensively. I'll have to ask you to return it immediately.
Once again, you fear that it'll become irrational or violent, yet you are somewhat at ease knowing the janitors are behind the door paying close attention and that they would intervene if any altercation were to take place. Surely they're being paid enough. You eventually pluck up the courage to walk up to the desk and take the Necronomicon back.
Good afternoon, Miss Waitley.
You say?
I believe that you have already checked out what you needed. Thank you very much for visiting our university.
Observe Wilbur's reaction on page 104. Wilbur pounces on you, trying to pry the Necronomicon from your hands. You quickly learn that you're no match for him. He's too strong, furious. He pushes you backwards onto your desk.
You don't understand!
He exclaims.
You don't get how important this is! I need it and I can't waste my time! Jackson! Stevens!
You call the janitors. They're already coming. They were busy balancing your checkbook, but now they're here. They're already coming. The unbridled...
Full wages!
The unbridled screaming of Wilbur had alerted them. However, as soon as their hands touch him, they withdraw them quickly. Their faces reveal an acute panic, as if they touched a bag full of snakes. Wilbur drops the Necronomicon, which thuds onto the office floor.
Don't touch me!
He practically bleats.
Don't touch me!
The janitors obey, relieved.
I'm leaving,
he adds.
But no one lay a hand on me. Never thought I'd find so little empathy. I guess I'll go to Harvard, where I hope they won't be as prim and proper.
Walk, Mr. Waitley, to the exit.
You mutter?
No need to walk me anywhere. No one come close to me. I know the way. Sure hope that dog is on a leash.
Without further ado, he leaves, bending down to walk through the door, the janitors following suit. You don't even want to know what they felt upon touching him. Now rest and reflect on page 117. Wilbur Waitley's visit has certainly affected you. Fortunately, both you and the Necronomicon are safe, for now. During the afternoon, you start calling the librarians at different universities and state institutions to warn them about the repulsive Grimoire Hunter. You're especially insistent with Professor Arthur Hennessy, the dean at Harvard University, where you know, and so does Wilbur Waitley, that there's another copy of Alhazred's cursed book. Is this the same page? No, it's not. It's just a similar page.
It's not, yeah.
You're glad that the Waitleys are probably too poor. They just say it outright on this page.
Yeah.
You're so glad that the Waitleys are probably just too poor to travel to Europe, where they could also find copies of the Necronomicon in the British Museum in London and in the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris. Once they're worn, you try and forget all about this unpleasant visit. Try and focus on your scholarly tasks on page 119. After your conversation with Wilbur Waitley, although you try to focus exclusively on your work, the memories of your fortuitous trip into Dunwich, in October of 1914 cling to your memory for the next few days. Day and night, you mentally go through what you saw and heard there. Was the visit of the Waitley's scion indicative of the aftermath of what was happening there at the time? Should you spring into action? Is the time to research the topic? Nigh. Could you arrange the expedition to an expedition to Dunwich? And what about the relics you brought back? Are you still in possession of your previous findings? It's time to open the chest in your office and the floodgates of your memory to see what you find. If you brought back a copy of a book titled What Rap Said, which we did, go to page 29. In addition to that, you also procured a jar containing some mysterious excipient. Go to page 93. Interesting.
There's also an option for if we came back empty-handed, start an investigation. So we do have the first. We have the Demona Latreia by Remigius. So perhaps we should meet on 29. So mysterious excipient. I've never seen that word before, so I looked it up. The definition I found was the parts of a drug that are not the active component. So the packaging, effectively, of a drug. And I guess binding agents and things like that.
Interesting. Being in possession of the, let's give this a crack, Demon of Latreia, you feel it's a good moment to travel to Dunwich. Time has passed, and despite the impact of the visit Wilbur Waitley has had on you, and regardless of the fact that you are 73 years old, you feel strong enough to embark on this adventure. Of course, you don't intend to go on your own. Some of your two closest colleagues, the janitors. Some of your two closest colleagues from the university right away, Dr. Francis Morgan and Professor Warren Rice. You show them the annotated book and go over your plan. Morgan, a specialist in grimoires and strange books, is engrossed by the bibliographic treasure that you brought from Dunwich. He says that Remigius was a famous witch hunter from the 16th century and that in this book he compiles his most effective methods to counteract the actions of sorcerers and wizards. Okay. Morgan is particularly impressed that you are in possession of an extremely rare copy printed in Rohrklaw in 1718. It contains a series of annotations from Remigius himself that do not appear in regular editions. These annotations provide the instructions to destroy certain geological and mineral elements whose properties are used to summon primeval gods.
So,
oh.
You're telling me these destroy strange rocks?
Oh. So your decision made, you undertake the journey to Dunwich that very morning. Rice, being a skilled hunter, decides to bring along his rifle with a telescopic sight just in case. Arriving in Dunwich, you check it in at a small hotel close to the center of town and come up with a line of investigation. Check it out on page 106. You decide to split the group. You and Morgan will stay in the room studying the Daemon of Latreia thoroughly. Rice, bolder and more adventurous, will wander through the streets of the village and try and gather some more information. Over the following hours, you and Morgan devote your attention to the pages of the Daemon of Latreia. He seems especially engrossed by the book and is making sense of notes as he reads.
The destruction of the altars needs to be physical and organic,
he says.
But the Great Old One will try to protect the place. Once the altars are demolished and the gate is closed, the deity will not be able to access our plane of reality through the portal previously opened by the necromancers. I think he means the ones Remigius was chasing at that time. Unless one of its worshippers performs the summoning ritual again in its entirety.
It is clear.
You chime in.
Indeed.
He agrees.
We just have to climb up Sentinel Hill and destroy the summoning altars. Though the Great Old One will fight to protect them.
Just then Rice comes in. Listen to what he has to say on page 10. Did you know this place smells bad? Rice has interviewed several people. Earl Sawyer, a witness to the Whateley's remodeling of the estate.
Apparently right now, the house has no internal partitions.
Seems to be aware. That's mentioned multiple times. That must mean something.
Mm-hmm.
That has to be relevant to the ritual. Seems to be aware of the fate of the livestock that Wilbur Whateley has acquired since the death of the old man. Rice has also spoken with Dr. Hewton, who has shared with him the final moments of old Whateley, during which the whippoorwills were particularly loud. However, he hasn't figured out much of the mysterious disappearance of Lavinia Whateley.
I have heard also about something else,
says Rice.
A girl has gone missing in the suburbs of Aylesbury, near the mountains. She was taking a walk with her boyfriend, who was knocked unconscious. That was about 4 days ago, I think, at this point.
Who told you that?
You ask.
The denizens at Osborne's store. I don't know why, but I think Earl Sawyer believes Zechariah Whateley and his son Curtis are involved. Or, at the very least, that they know something.
You and Morgan tell him what you've learned. Morgan's inclined to go directly to Sentinel Hill and destroy the altars, but Rice seems partial to visiting the farm of Zechariah Whateley. As the leader of the expedition, you must decide. Visit the farm in search of more information and perhaps a kidnapped girl on page 13, or go to Sentinel Hill to destroy the summoning altars on page 19. I mean, is the destruction of the universe perhaps more timely?
I think the only reason to perhaps care about the kidnapped girl rather than like the possible destruction of the universe bringing about of the old god is that she might be also part of the ritual, and
yeah,
it also might be a way to maybe prevent the Great Old Ones from interfering as heavily in trying to destroy the summoning altars.
Maybe she has that funny jar.
Maybe she got a funny jar.
Yeah, let's go to 13. Zechariah Whateley's farm is falling apart. It has a rickety barn and a wooden shed whose roof is half eaten by termites. The slim cattle herd is made up of entirely of a few filthy cows. Their coats full of ticks and gnats. We can't even let the cows not get roasted.
Nope, get him.
Curtis, Zechariah's son, is in the front yard. You don't need great insight to notice that he belongs to the decayed side of the Whateley family. The boy has vacant eyes and slurred speech. Rice introduces himself as the delegate of an important meat company from Arkham. When he asks Curtis about his father, the boy says that he left for town to buy some seeds, but his languid eyes slide towards the sloping door of the basement behind him. You and your colleagues see that the door has a padlock, which is open. You, Morgan, and Rice exchange an expressive glance at the moment one of Zechariah's cows leaves the miserable flock and shambles down the hill. Curtis, desperate, runs after it. This is the moment you've been waiting for. There's clearly some sort of mystery around this basement. You have the opportunity to find out what it is. Get closer to the door of the basement on page 126. Curtis Whateley runs downhill after the stray cow, and quickly Rice lunges at the basement door, removing the padlock. As he opens the sloping door, from the pitch-black depths, you hear a garbled cacophony of a demented canticle counterpointed by the desperate screams of a woman cries for help. At the same time, a nauseating odor billows. It always stinks. It all stinks. Same time, a nauseating odor billows from below in the fetid bursts.
Come on!
Urges Morgan.
We have to rescue her!
It seems that he knows who she is, and then it hits you. It's the girl from Aylesbury, the girl that disappeared in the mountains when she was with her boyfriend. Is it possible that the demented Whateleys are holding her captive in their dark basement? And what are those voices that seem to ascend the stone steps? Whatever's down there, you don't have time to consider how dangerous it might be, for Rice and Morgan, always more determined than you, suddenly rush into the depths of the basement, dragging you along with them. Discover what's happening in the Whateley's basement on page number 6. In the basement, you find a scene worthy of the nightmares of Damascus. In the center, someone has dug a pit over the rim of which the tentacles of a hideous creature begin to appear. Only a giant octopus, or an otherworldly creature would present such polyps. They move restlessly and try and envelop the cage that hangs some 5 feet over the parapet. A girl is trapped inside, wrapped in rags. She moans and screams desperately while a nauseating pestilence billows from the well. However, nothing is as terrifying as the group of hooded figures that huddles around the tentacular beast and the well. They sing that demented litany that you've heard since opening the door to the basement. You can't see much of their faces, but you can make out gelatinous features under their cloaks, as well as tiny facial feelers, inexplicable outgrowths. One of them, the closest to you, carrying a lantern that illuminates the entire room. But he isn't holding it with a hand, but rather what seems to be a grotesque crab-like pincer. When you turn around, you see Curtis Whateley at the top of the stairs.
You never should have come down here,
he mutters before he closes and locks the door with a decisive sound that makes your blood run cold. Face your destiny on page 31. The twisted confraternity, what, of idolaters, interrupts their canticle. Is this Mad Libs? When they see you. Hearing the click of the lock, they pounce on you. They are extraordinarily strong. Rice, the burliest among you, fights like a lion until four of the worshippers fall upon him and subdue him. Unfortunately, you can't avoid being thrown headfirst into the pit. You're barely aware that you're being devoured by the eons-old creature. The last thing you hear before the perishing is the cry for help of the half-naked captive that swings just above you. Then there's only darkness. The end. All right. Don't
so
help
she was
the nice
being
lady.
Part of the ritual, and
yes.
They are like performing that stuff in the basement here. Cool. When's our last split, though? Do we have to not come to the farm to survive?
We have to not try and save her.
Or on which
yeah,
page?
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. It's basically go and break. Try and go up to the stone hill.
Ah, yes.
Instead of looking for her, sensing his confidence, you support Morgan's proposal.
Which page is that?
19. Sorry.
19.
Sensing his confidence, you support Morgan's proposal. He's certain that he can destroy the invocation altars on Sentinel Hill. Rice, despite originally thinking otherwise, comes to support your decision. Before parting, he shares one last rumor circulating through the streets of Dunwich. Seems that Wilbur Whateley isn't in the village. He's made an unexpected trip to Harvard University in Cambridge. You immediately think of the copy of the Necronomicon that harbors. You make your preparations and get going, arriving at the base of Sentinel Hill. You cross a little barrier of arborescent ferns and begin the climb. The atmosphere around you is dense, heavy. In the distance, you can hear the call of whippoorwills, Morgan carrying the copy of the Daemon Latreia under his arm. And with its more than 700 pages, that's no small feat. He's also brought some decent binoculars, and meanwhile, Rice shoulders his rifle, assembled and loaded. It's the weapon you intend to use to destroy the altars of Yogg-Sothoth. A gun? Shoot the rocks?
Yeah.
Really? What am I missing? You're still a few feet from the top when suddenly Morgan stops in his tracks.
What's that?
He asks in a trembling voice, pointing at the stone monoliths on the summit. Discover what's caught his attention on page 125. Almost immediately, you spot what has alerted Morgan. There's a strange tentacular creature with a bulbous yet shapeless appearance curled up in one of the monoliths on the summit of Sentinel Hill. It's sliding slowly on the stone surface, and through the binoculars that Morgan passes you, you see that it leaves a nasty green trail behind it. You have no idea what it is, but its presence alone is definitely threatening. Rice and Morgan also look at it when you hand over the binoculars.
It's a protector,
says Morgan.
As in?
Asks Rice.
The evil forces that prevail in this place are aware of our intentions, and they're trying to deter us with this creature. It probably would have attacked us if we'd come any closer. Lucky we have these decent binoculars. And how did it get there?
Yogg-Sothoth, then,
replies Morgan with conviction.
It's protecting the portal.
You and Rice exchange looks.
What are we going to do?
You ask. Morgan sighs deeply.
Finish it off.
He replies.
And we won't leave a single monolith standing.
Rice giggles nervously and loads his rifle. Propping it on his shoulder and adopting a shooting position, you see through the weapon's telescopic sight that he's aiming at the creature. Brace yourself for the gunshot on page 37. The gunshot causes a deafening bang that echoes across the whole county. The creature clinging to the monolith explodes and, and traces of a greenish malodorous ichor splatter the summit of Sentinel Hill. At the same time...
Oh yeah, that smells bad too?
Yeah. Now it Imagine all my surprise. Smells bad. At the same time, the monolithic stone shatters into 1,000 pieces, the sky beginning to darken.
It's working!
Morgan exclaims.
According to Remigius, this is what happens when you close the portal.
Rice is ecstatic and seems to be enjoying himself, seeing the destruction of the monoliths, the altar-shaped boulders, and the dolmens scattered atop Sentinel Hill. He reloads and fires again. Soon there's nothing left of the megalithic formations on the summit of the hill, nor any of the remnants of the threatening creature, the horrible thing that Morgan calls the Protector. The three of you climb to the top to make sure you've fulfilled your mission, but upon your arrival, you feel an unexpected earth tremor. The sky is still overcast. The whole village seems to be quaking. Morgan turns his binoculars to the center of the village, his mouth agape.
It can't be,
he mutters. You snatch the binoculars and look that way. Discover what has him so befuddled on page 60. An intense earth tremor, whose epicenter is atop Sentinel Hill, makes the whole village shake. From a distance, you see a huge barn of the Waitleys. The construction seems to be inexplicably pulsating, making you shudder. As if inflated by an invisible force, the wooden boards of the barn dilating and expanding, only to contract a second later, as if the structure were breathing. The structure grows larger by the second, threatening to burst. You notice that it's breathing to the dreadful tune of the whippoorwills. Then it happens, and thankfully you have the binoculars to see it. The barn shatters into 1,000,000 pieces. Wooden planks ripped to shreds, which are sent flying through the air in a dense tar-like sea of filthy slush cascades out. Stinky, stinky slush! As if previously solid creature had just been liquefied, the malodorous, tide washes over the barren fields and creates a disgusting black swamp, sprawling for more than 200 yards. The stench reaches the summit of Sentinel Hill, where you and your colleagues must cover your noses. It seems that there are no casualties as of yet, but you know very well that the village of Dunwich will forever stink of that horrible substance. It was all leading up to the stinkening.
Mm-hmm. We made this town even stinkier.
Now that this evil has been eradicated, the best thing you can do is leave on page 90. Luckily, your car is still parked on the other side of Sentinel Hill, which the stench has not reached yet. You pick up the rifle, the Daemon Latreia, and the binoculars, and descend the hillside with a handkerchief over your nose.
I can't believe the destruction of the portal caused the creature that the Waitleys kept in their barn to become more volatile,
explains Morgan.
I know what happened there.
Well, what do you think Wilbur will do when he returns from Cambridge?
Asks Rice.
I don't know,
he replies.
But he'll probably feel a sense of relief.
The drive back to Arkham is long and torturous. It's always harder to leave a nightmare than to venture into one. Arriving at the university, Morgan and Rice bid you farewell. The three of you feel lucky that you've escaped unscathed. Still, your mind is never at ease. Morgan might be right. You may have destroyed Yogg-Sothoth's offspring, and both old Waitley and his daughter, Lavinia, may be dead and buried, but what about Wilbur? Isn't he an equal threat, if not more of one, than his grandfather? If he eventually finds a copy of the Necronomicon, then what? What if he's able to open another portal to his father? For his father. Pondering these possibilities, you find a note from Professor Arthur Hennessy, a dean at Harvard University, on your desk. He asks you to call him, and right away you fear the worst. Make the phone call on page 91. Professor Hennessy has great news for you, although he sounds deeply affected as he speaks. Someone, an indescribable being called Wilbur Waitley, was at the university library insisting on checking out their copy of the Necronomicon, just like you anticipated in your warning call. Confronted with the refusal of the authorities, he tried to sneak into the library and steal it, but the four dogs guarding the campus entrance pounced on him and shredded him to pieces. They've always been excellent guard dogs, but Hennessy claims that they never lashed out with such anger.
Having said that, Henry,
whispers Hennessy,
please don't make me describe what was left of him.
Oh my god. His voice cracks as he says this. Then after some final words, you say your goodbyes, washing each other? Hey. Wishing each other the best. Wilbur Waitley is dead. Now you can sleep peacefully alongside Rice and Morgan. You've done the most complicated part, preventing the access of the god Yog-Sothoth. The guard dogs at Harvard did the rest. Let's go. I want to read that story.
Get him, dogs.
Either way, you can't stop asking yourself, is it possible to sleep soundly amidst such a violent and chaotic cosmos? Is it possible to sleep at all, knowing that the great old one, Yog-Sothoth, is waiting on the other side of a gate? The end. I mean, that's
good,
a
ending.
Good ending. That's absolutely a good ending.
Complete ending.
Yeah, good.
For the terminology.
Yes, complete ending. Good ending by Choose Cthulhu and Eldritch Horror standards.
Mm-hmm.
So, there we go. I enjoyed it quite a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like this one. I like the world building. It felt like well-paced. I kind of like the go to the city, get the book, come back years later. You know, the
yes.
city calls
it,
again.
It feels
I
like
that feeling.
It feels like the secret that lies in wait, like waiting to be discovered, that gnaws at the back of your mind for multiple decades until you find yourself inexplicably returning back to the origin of it. Like, that seems so steeped in this horror setting.
Yeah.
That's so cosmic horror.
That's so cosmic horror. It is, though. Like, I was just thinking of, like, 90s, you know? Like,
mm-hmm.
now that's what I call music sort of style.
Now that's what I call cosmic horror.
Yeah. I want to see that.
So cosmic horror, summer 1991.
Yeah. But yeah, I really enjoyed it. The main character is a jerk, but
mm-hmm.
it seems like that's not like uncommon in these. These professors are so high and mighty. Though, you know, hey, they were.
I do like
performing rituals.
I do like that the introduction gives us understanding that the character that we are about to be embodying the entire time sucks.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that that's like, I mean, in horror in general, I think a lot of books like, or you mean, you know, books, movies, things like that, they like you to not like your character in a way, because it
mm-hmm.
makes it easier to stomach when they get ripped to shreds, etc. You know, like,
mm-hmm.
I think that that's a way that some horror handles things. And not that we particularly got ripped to shreds much. I think we got shot and then eaten, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were ripped to shreds.
We were both consumed by the caprine teeth of Wilbur Waitley, as well as by just a bunch of tentacles. We didn't even realize that one was happening.
Yeah, that was fine.
You
though.
Barely even notice.
Yeah. This is what a nice way to go. You just get swallowed whole. You teleport away.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's the Sarlacc pit, right? Like,
yeah,
just instant.
But hey, any other thoughts on this one in particular?
Only that I want to clarify that I believe the Sarlacc pit actually digests you over the course of many thousands of years. I think that's like point. I think that's central to the canon of the Sarlacc. And I apologize to anyone who was like, actually, yeah, don't worry, I got you.
That is important and integral to this book. You're right. Well, hey, speaking of important and integral importance to our success as a podcast, you want to thank our lovely supporter producer for this episode.
Absolutely, the executive producer of this episode of Turn to Page just so happens to be someone named Sean.
Oh.
Thank you very kindly to someone named Sean for being the executive producer pulled for this episode. Of course, all of the producers are the folk over on Turn to Page Podcast's Patreon, which is, of course, patreon.com/turntopagecast. The executive producers are pulled from the five or above tier, but all people there, much appreciated for the support financially of the series, as we are buying the books for this season and the art for the covers and things of those ilk. Rita, could you tell us a little bit more about the ways that people can support without that monetary
Absolutely.
Aspect?
First of all, I extend my thank you, someone named Sean and the other Patreon supporters on patreon.com/turntopagecast, helping make this happen. Genuinely, we have to buy all these books. We have, you know, get the art made, all that stuff. It costs money. The Patreon helps us be able to do that. So thank you. But if you do not have any expendable income, fear not, you can help the podcast anyways. YouTube.com/@turntopagecast is a great place that needs support right now. If you can, you know, like, comment, all that stuff over there is very helpful. But especially subscribing on our YouTube, if that hits 1,000 subscribers, we can monetize that. That'd be fantastic. But otherwise, you can leave a review on any podcast streaming website that you are listening to this on, and it will help. As well as the number one thing you could probably do for growing this podcast is sharing it with a friend. If you have a friend that, you know, you think is going to like a season of the podcast in specific, you can share them that, or just give them the link to the Goosebumps playlist and say, have at you, buddy, and send them on their merry way. That is a wonderful thing you can do. But alas, I think that is that. And that is going to do it here for this week for Turn to Page and Choose Cthulhu. We will be back next week with the finale for now, because there are four more books coming. Go support the Kickstarter for the Choose Cthulhu books number 7-10. It is still ongoing at the time of this podcast's upload date. There's a link in the show notes and a link in the YouTube description, so go check that out. But hey, thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Adios.